Welcome to Milestone, Celebrating the Culture. I'm your host, Angelica Beener. This is a very special episode of Milestones because we are celebrating a century of innovative sound, style, righteous rebellion, exhilarating reinvention. We're celebrating 100 years of the incomparable Miles Davis. And I'm super excited to introduce you to our guests for this special episode. I'm like genuinely like giddy. These are two of the best to ever do it in their fields. And I am happy to call them both my friends and my brothers. Joining us is Grammy-winning trumpeter and composer Keon Harold and Grammy-winning legendary hip-hop producer Easy Mo B. Thank you both so much for being here.
A pleasure to be here with you.
Yay! Okay, so here's what's interesting, right? You two both have Grammys for your work with Miles Davis. I just think that's such a remarkable parallel that we'll get into, you know, some more in some more detail in a bit. But to kick things off, I'd love to ask each of you how, as best you can describe it, because I know how that is to say, well, when did you learn of Miles Davis or when? But as best as you can you tell me about when you became aware of Miles Davis?
Let's start. Let me jump in first because this is important. I remember I was 11 years old, like in 1991 or 92, maybe 92. And my sister buying me a Miles Davis album, and it was That Doo-Bop Sound, you know. What? And yeah. So,
whoa,
you know, she got me that for Christmas. I remember she was working at the store and she brought me that. So, you know, that's, you know, I was listening to other, you know, records about Miles Davis, but that was one of the first ones that I could hold by myself. She got me the tape. So, you know, anyway, I say that to say that, you know, Easy, you are the GOAT, man. And, you know, it's an honor to be on here with you. That was just an intro to saying thank you, Easy. That's all.
Man, thank you. Thank you, Keon. GOAT? I don't know about that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
We do.
It's just so many people that come before you, you know, that'll make you feel like that. For instance, like Miles, like when I got the indication from my manager that I was going to be working with him, I didn't feel worthy. First of all, I was already only 2 years in the business. That's it. I wow. came in with two songs on Big Daddy Kane's second album in 1989. So imagine I'm 2 years in, I'm still green. I had to even actually ask myself, like, yo, can you do this? But to answer your question, the whole reason why I'm here is because of, rest in peace, my father. My father, he loved music. He always had a lot of records in the house. He didn't have as much as me. All right, so my father used to play a lot of records. He had a lot of records, a lot of 45s, albums. But the spectrum of what he was playing was very typical blues, soul, funk a little late on, James Brownish type things. And then he had like a couple of jazz records. And he had a Kenny Burrell album. He had a Cannonball Adderley album. In particular, it was the album Why Am I Treated So Bad? And then he had this other album. It was like, it looked like a painting on the front. It was an orange background with a green horn painted on top. And I remember in black letters, I'm a little kid, this is Miles Davis live at Carnegie Hall. So And he used to play that. And then I would take the records. A lot of times when he would leave, I would take his records and sneak them into my room and listen to them because I wanted to get like a better listen. So Miles Davis Live at Carnegie Hall is my first introduction to him. Meeting up with Miles on vinyl, that was it.
Meeting up with Miles on vinyl. Yes, indeed. Keon, what about you? You're actually from you're from Ferguson. He's from East St. Louis?
East St. Louis.
And so can you talk to me about what's the proximity there in terms of just geography, but also, yeah, what was your introduction outside of, you know, getting doo-bop in your hands?
Mm-hmm. The geography was very close. Basically, East St. Louis is in Illinois. St. Louis is on the other side. It's literally just separated by water. You know, and at that time, you know, think about it, it's like, where would you play? The big city was St. Louis. So he would come over and play. As a matter of fact, he was, you know, a trumpet player in my cousin's band, the Eddie Randall and the Blue Devils. He was a member of that band, which is crazy. One of the first bands he was ever in. But Miles, you know, it's like, my grandfather used to tell me about Miles all the time. My father used to tell me about Miles. Obviously, the stories, you know, just him, just St. Louis lore of Miles Davis before I really got into it. Then, you know, my dad used to be like, you know, we're gonna learn how to play, you know, Porgy and Bess. We learn how to play in Summertime. And I would sit at the end of his bed, you know, trying to perfectly play Summertime. You know, that's kind of my introduction to Miles Davis. Obviously it goes a lot deeper than that, but that was kind of the intro between my grandfather and my dad, and knowing that my cousin's band, you know, Miles Davis was a part of it a long time ago.
That is insane, Keon. Like, wow, incredible. And there are so many great trumpeters from St. Louis, right? Can you talk about just the pedigree of trumpeters, including yourself, who all come from here?
Yeah, some in the water. I was talking to Chris McBride the other day about that. It seems like some in the water. We talk about Russell Gunn. We talk about, you know, Clark Terry and, you know, so many others, and Lester Bowie and so many others. Very unique sound, very incredible stylistic artists that were very different, that were, you know, searching to find their own sound and push music forward or in the way that they felt music should go.
Wow. Incredible. And so, yeah, we opened up, you know, just talking about this incredible parallel that you both have in that you share, in that you both have done Miles Davis projects in different ways, but there's still, you know, there's some overlap here. And so Easy Mo B, Doobop, was Miles Davis's last project before he passed away in September of 1991. And you exclusively produced this album. It comes out posthumously in 1992. Can you take us back to that time? Like you, I'm assuming you get a phone call or somebody knocks on your door. How do you get the news that there's even a conversation about Miles Davis wanting to meet you or work with you? Can you take us back to that time?
Well, back then, speaking about hip hop, most of the artists at that time were managed by Russell Simmons at Rush Artist Management. Mm-hmm. But he also had a producer management division called RPM. And in that division, there was a woman that was managing me named Francesca Sparrow. And she was the one that I conferred with daily. Moby, we need to do this. Such and such needs tracks. So one day she told me, she said, Russell has been hanging out with Miles.
Wow.
He wants to get into hip hop. So I'm thinking of sending over a reel of your tracks and maybe set up a meeting to go and just kind of like meet him, feel him out, play him some music. And I ended up right over there, Central Park West, between, I think it was between 88 and 89. I went to the apartment and I came in and he just sitting, just staring at me. I have no idea if he studied me or if he heard music I had done before that, beforehand. But I came in with a couple of tracks. One in particular that I felt like was crafted and made just for him. I felt like he could fit on it. And that was the doo-bop song. It was just a bare track. I had the Summer Madness DJ Premier, it's a deep concentration thing, kind of mixed together with elements of EPMD's Your Customer. It just came together in some kind of way. I just felt like it just fit. And I played it, and he liked it. He was nodding his head. He was in a boo. And then after that, Francesca had sent over a reel ahead of time for him to listen to me and just kind of get familiar with me. So on that cassette reel was the Big Daddy Kane stuff I had did, and I had worked at that point with the Genius. We all know later on he became GZA.
Mm-hmm.
I had an album on Cold Chillin', same label as Kane. And there was a song that I did on his album that was on that cassette reel called True Fresh MC. And I've always been a heavy Bomb Squad fan. You know, all the music for like Public Enemy. And so this track, it had that like Public Enemy kind of feel, real progressive. So when it came on, because I didn't know what Francesca had put on the cassette reel she sent over. So I don't even know what's coming on next on the tape. So when that comes on, I actually kind of tensed up and I got scared because I was like, yo, run him off. Like, he might not like this. This is turning him off. Mm. But he's going like this. And he was looking at the entertainment stereo center, you know, where they have the tuner, receiver, mm-hmm, tape, mm-hmm, turntable on top all together. He was staring at that. And he was looking at me. And then after a while, in that whispery voice, he turned to me while he was nodding. He said, "You'll do that for me." I was like, "You want me to do that for you? What I'm playing is something influenced by like Public Enemy. And you want me to do that for you?" I didn't say that to him, but in my mind, it's what I'm thinking. So I answered. I was like, I was glad. I felt more comfortable, you know, that he liked the sound. I just said, "Yeah, yeah." And I kept nodding my head. He kept nodding his head. And as if it wasn't enough, he needed like, seemed like he needed a second approval. Kept nodding his head. He looked over at me. He asked me again. He said, "You'll do that for me." And then that's when I had to giggle a little bit. I laughed and I said, I laughed. I was like, "Yeah, Lonnie's here." And so from that point on, I felt comfortable.
Yeah. And this album, you know, ends up winning the Grammy for Best R&B Instrumental Performance that year. Now, I want to stick a pin in that category that it was nominated for, right? Because I feel like, and this is where I want to get some input from you, Keon, you know, you guys worked on a Miles Davis project almost 25 years apart, right? They both are widely acclaimed, you know, not without some controversy, right? Because Miles Davis is inherently controversial, if you will, because apparently being bold is controversial, right? Being encompassing the fullness of Black art and creativity is somehow controversial, right? But
you know what? I think a shorter description of that would be free. he was free. Mm-hmm. And anytime, you know, a black person has the air of freedom, that's disruptive.
Ooh, that's well said. Keon, you supplied all of the trumpet playing in the Oscar-nominated actor Don Cheadle's Miles Davis biopic, Miles Ahead. The soundtrack, again, won a Grammy for Best Compilation Soundtrack for Visual Media. Can you tell me a little bit about what that process is like in terms of not just the study and whatever you had to do to gain the channeling, which I'd love for you to tell me about, but also what does that do to you mentally? I'm thinking of both of you and just like the weight of this. Like this is like just the weight of something this iconic. Can you take me back to that feeling?
Oh man, that was a crazy time. I was, you know, in transition in life. And, you know, when I got the call that it was possibly happening, you know, the first part was the demos. And basically, you know, that went over well. But, you know, just getting into that mindset of somebody great as Miles Davis as a trumpet player, it's like, what's higher than that? And it's like, okay, so the idea is to basically perform, you know, I can never be Miles. That's never an issue. But to live in a space that honors his legacy, that honors the way he played, that honors everything that is that he left, that could be intimidating, you know, for many reasons. But at the same time, you know, it's a part of my DNA. So it's the equivalent of, you know, basically having to show up and speak for your parent, you know, which is, you know, an incredible thing. And, you know, again, when we grow up, our parents tell us all kind of stuff and we'd be like, yeah, whatever. Then all of a sudden you start, you know, getting in certain situations, grown up situations, and all of a sudden you start to hear a voice that was very familiar and that you learned from that was, you know, a part of your upbringing. Then you start to speak those words and all of a sudden, oh, it was always instilled in me. It wasn't something that I needed to learn. It was something that was, you know, me growing up transcribing and listening to all of Miles' music. It's just a part of my makeup as an artist, as a trumpet player.
Mm.
And you know, and having the opportunity to basically, I guess, keep the legacy going, keep the party going, you know, I just basically use what I knew.
Oof, that's deep. That's deep. Yeah. It's interesting, right? Because you were talking about the hindsight, right? Like that voice that comes to you and now it comes with a clarity and like just when you need it, you in many ways were working toward this without maybe necessarily knowing specifically, but you had already been, you know, being a vessel made mm-hmm. for this moment. Did it feel like that? Was there a sort of like a spiritual element to it as well?
Absolutely. And that's exactly, you know, what it was. It was kind of like an understanding that, you know, I got the message, you know, and, you know, that's it. It was time to share that message. You know, sometimes we get tested, you know, what do you actually know? What do you really know? Did you really hear it? Did you really understand it? Did you really get it? And that was the ultimate, you know, test. And again, the connection again to Miles Davis spiritually is, you know, that's everything, you know, that's aspirational for me. And the fact that I'm on the call with Easy is just like, you know, I've been seeing Easy for the last, you know, couple of months. And it's just been, you know, the kind of thing that we've been talking, but at the same time, I'm just kind of like so inspired and just so amazed at the idea that he had the opportunity and time to sit down with Miles and make something so incredible and timeless is just special to me. So, you know, Easy, again, you are the GOAT, man. I'm gonna keep saying that, you know?
Man, I just love what you do, and I continually hear echoes of Miles in you, man.
To that end, Mo B, my understanding, but definitely, you know, want to hear it from your mouth, is that Miles got sick in the middle of the project. And so you had, I believe it was 6 songs that were done before he passed, and then 2 to 3 more after. So I guess my question is twofold, not to throw so much at you, but can you talk about how you approached song selection? And were you, he obviously liked some work that you had already done, right? But then now you're crafting specifically for him, and then he gets sick in the middle. So can you just kind of talk a little bit about your musical approach while he was here, and then maybe what you had to do mentally and spiritually, you know, after he passed, to continue it on?
Musically, when I went about starting to make the music for Miles, I just kind of went off. You have elements of what he has done and what I could tell that he liked. Of course, we know he experimented with funk. Then you have his latest stuff, which included drum machines. Took a long time for Miles to get to that point, but he did. And then there's the stuff that I played him in the meeting, the doo-wop song. You might as well say that's cool again. You have Slick Rick in there, because we are the best. Okay. I started to try to, like, push the envelope a little bit. I didn't know what he thought about Donald Byrd. But I said, I'm going to take something from another great trumpeter and kind of like create something where he could do his own version on their song. That track became High Speed Chase. And mind you, High Speed Chase is one of the 2 songs that was done after he fell sick, because we got 6 songs done. Let's talk about what we got done. Because his manager had stepped to me in the session and said, look, Miles has to do some chilling. We got to travel. So he said, we'll be back. But then while they was out on the road, I got the message, Gordon Meltzer. That's what it was in his name. So he called me back and he said, look, Miles has fell sick. He may not be able to finish the album. So what we want you to do is go into the vaults, the Warner Brothers vaults, and we're going to come up with like 2 songs that we want you to remix. He said, you have 6 songs. I'm going to explain those 6 songs.
Okay.
He said, well, you'll remix those 2 that will make 8. And then he said, mystery. He said, we'll add like a reprise of that, and that makes 9. Mm-hmm. So you have mystery, which is, sometimes I wonder, where did this term come from? I think I read somewhere that Giles Peterson created the term. But mystery is like acid jet. Next, after that on the album, I'm trying to see and hear the album in my mind. After that, Chocolate Chip. Chocolate Chip was just like, just plain funky. A lot of swing to it. There's a bridge in there with an insertion of snippets from Young Hope Unlimited. I just tried to go to like a lot of the real gritty and funky jazz stuff. It just kind of, that was Chocolate Chip. Then after that, Fantasy. Oh, Fantasy was, no, we did that together. We recorded that together. Fantasy is just like straight hip hop. And he's blowing on top of it. And I thought that I was going to be just producing. I come from a group called Rapping is Fundamental.
Mm-hmm. And y'all was singing in that group.
Harmonizing, doo-wopping, and I'm rapping. So we did that on doo-bop, because doo-bop was the first song to get made. And then along the way, you need to rap on this. Yeah, you need to rap again on that one. Those songs were Fantasy and Blow. Yo, you know what I loved about Blow that was so cool? And this was the indication to me that Miles liked me and that this was really gonna work. In one of the sessions, Gordon Meltzer, his manager, came over to me with like a little micro cassette recorder. And Gordon used to talk really soft. He said, "Hey, easy. Listen, Miles has this greeting on his phone at home, and we thought it would be a good idea. We just kind of attach it to the beginning of the song Blow." And I was like, yeah, cool. He says, "You want to hear it?" I was like, "Did." So we had did a demo version of Blow. It was unfinished. Miles took that home. On the greeting, you can hear Blow playing in the background. The music comes on for about 2 or 3 seconds, and then he says, "It's gonna be a milestone. It's gonna blow."
Yo.
Who they showed me that? I was
Hey.
like, "Yo, wait a minute. Miles is at home putting the music we did on his greeting, and I don't know, Herbie Hancock, don't know, Cicely Tyson, whoever is calling his house, and the first thing they hear is gonna be a milestone." I felt so like verified. Mind you, in the beginning, the album was supposed to be, I think I was just supposed to do a couple of tracks, because a whole slew of other producers was invited also too there to his apartment. But Gordon told me, said that his manager told me, said that he liked me so much that he just wanted to finish out and do the rest of the whole thing with me. Moving along to the other songs, you have Sonya, which is just like, I would call that like modern jazz. Definitely not in the vein of traditional. That's like the modern jazz. I remember like in the late 80s and the early 90s. Anybody from New York that is watching this video, they know what I'm talking about. New York had a jazz station called CD 101. Sonya, to me, I pictured it on that station. What's crazy is after the song was made, they played it. I have to also give credit to along the way and throughout the process of the album, my, at Miles' suggestion, he paired me together with Darren Johnson, amazing keyboard player. And Darren would do is on certain tracks, I would get like the my basic skeleton. It could even be like a full track, but he would have Darren come in and like add some keys, or maybe like a solo. Like the doo-bop song is entirely me, but when the song is going off on the in the vamp, that solo, that's Darren.
Got it.
And I'm also on Duke Booty, which is like funky swing hip hop, might as well say. I was talking with I ran into Teddy Riley recently, and I told Teddy, I said, you influenced me highly, man. I said, if you would go back and listen to Blow on Miles Davis' album, I said, you'll hear a lot of you and names, like dudes and names. It's just crazy the way how I pulled in all of these different influences of music from me growing up and the sounds around me that I liked, and I just tried to put them all together on that album.
That is incredible because I'm hearing a parallel again between you two where you may not have known it, but you were being prepared for this moment. Like that vast musical upbringing that you had, you know, because I'm like, you know, when during the pandemic and stuff, when I would see you on Twitch, you know, and you're playing house, funk, soul, you know, But we, you know, our generation knows you from Big and, you know, Pac and all this stuff. It was like, it was a revelation to, I think, a lot of people, just how much music you know and love, right? And that you are not one-dimensional by any, you know.
Just hip-hop. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. So in some ways, you guys are being, you know, prime. Yeah. For this moment. I know we don't have a lot of time left, so I really want to get into talking about hip-hop. Keon, your resume reads like, you know, you have these, they're not two worlds because it's all together, it's all music, right? But the way, for the industry's sake, right, for the way it's all categorized, you know, one would say on one hand, you've worked with Jay-Z, Beyonce, Common, Maxwell. And then on this other side, you know, you got Charles Tolliver and Dr. Lonnie Smith and all these other jazz greats and your own contemporaries in jazz that you work with. Shedrick Mitchell, Marcus Strickland, Glasper, all these people, and your own records, right? That, you know, certainly exemplify someone who's incredibly steeped in jazz, in the language and facility that we all marvel at, that is Keon Harrell. But also, you know, you're a product of the time. You know, you're a millennial who came up on Easy Mo B, Pete Rock, Primo, right? So can you talk a little bit about how, if or how Miles Davis is sort of a guiding light or an inspiration to you in that way where you can sort of, without compromise and without apology, do what you do?
100%. Again, you know exactly how to frame these things, and it's incredible. It's like, you know, again, I look at Miles as a gateway drug to being able to, you know, to do everything. And like you said, given the keys to the city and have the permission to break down all of the walls that might, you know, confuse people or stop people from exploring. Again, you know, the only, what's different, you know, we got 12 notes in traditional Western harmony. And then the only thing that's really changing the genres is the beat. You know, we got these chords and we got this and we, you know, maybe some words, but other than that, it's soul. And when I think of everything that Miles was throwing down, the first part is the blues and soul. And all of that stuff was translated, you know, through the different musicians, different instruments, and the beat. Other than that, it was all Miles traveling. So I was always inspired by the idea that if you build a sound and if you have an idea, that no matter what you do, that individuality can travel, no matter if you call it hip hop, no matter if you call it R&B, no matter if you call it whatever, because they're going to market it how they market it, no matter what. But it's the vibe that travels. And, you know, between Miles and Roy Hargrove, you know, they both, you know, made me know and gave me the license to do it all, to not be stopped, to not be limited by, oh my God, we can just play these chords, we can just play these changes, we can just play it in the club. It's about how do you place this music somewhere else that's accessible for a bigger audience. And Miles is, again, the gateway drug to that for me. I'm still inspired by it, but every day, every moment, you know, listening to all of the records, all the kinds of records, you know, especially Duval, especially, you know, his stuff in the 70s, you know, I'm doing a lot of work with the Miles Davis Electric Band. Shout out Vince Wilburn and Aaron and all, you know, it's incredible to keep that music going. But that music was, you know, a trampoline into what I believe, you know, about music and what I believe about myself as an artist to keep pushing this music forward.
I love that. I really, really love that. Yeah, I mean, you do it with such freedom. Like, that's the word you used earlier. And I love that. And I love that for us, you know, us as the culture, we get to... And thank you for bringing up Roy Hargrove as well. I think that he absolutely needs to be a part of that conversation. He made it cool to dress, you know, how we dressed and look how we look and still, you know, burn a hole in your whatever you know, with that. With
but,
that
I, but I gotta believe, and I'm 100% sure, even though I never asked him, that you know he was inspired by the idea of the way Miles did it. You know, again, as any trumpet player that's moving things in the right direction, and that's forward and adjacent and however it is, you know, Miles was a very big influential figure into, you know, the thought process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Easy, I want to ask you this. And I just have like two or three more questions. We have like 12 minutes. So, but I got to ask you about this. You sort of like a progenitor of hip hop and jazz colliding in this way, right? Like people like Keon, Glasper, Terrace Martin, Kamasi, they're doing it big now. And even I remember when, you know, Black Radio came out, like there was a lot of pushback, right? And this is decades after Dubac. There's still this like push and pull, right? But they're able to do what they do now, and it hasn't been without a price, right? There's always a lot of judgment before the sudden acclaim, you know, that happened with Thelonious, you know what I mean? For example. And Miles Davis, you know, how can I say this? You broke a lot of ceilings, right? Because doo-wop is pre-Jazzmatazz. It's, you know, pre, you know, everybody really knowing about Dilla. It's pre-Madlib, Shades of Blue. You know, you're really like a forefather in this kind of bringing this together, right? What does it mean to you now when you see somebody like Keon or Robert, you know, like taking that torch and you know, just continuing it on? Like, what does that feel like for you? And do you see yourself as a sort of, you know, one of the first, if not the first, you know, and doing it with Miles, right? Doing it with the
GOAT.
Yeah, right?
The GOAT.
We're just going to keep saying it. So
to answer your question, it makes me happy. And there was a lot of pushback. They didn't believe in it. And it's crazy because a lot of the same people that didn't believe in it and rendered it like destruction, they're all doing it. But see,
attempting to do it.
Yeah.
Come on now.
what's even better that I could say about that is this was eventual anyway. You have to remember that in the beginning when Grandmaster Flash, Grand Wizard Theodore, Cool Herc, all of those early DJs, when they was digging for breaks and break beats, the music came from everywhere, anywhere. Kiddie Records, funk, folk, funk, jazz, all the way as early as Nautilus, Bob James, and on top you have the To The Beat, John. I guess, yeah. So what I did with him, I feel like it was eventual. This was bound to happen. We were already cutting up the jazz breaks. The jazz was in the hip-hop. The jazz also started being sampled into the beats later in hip-hop. So it was only eventual that two artists would come together, you know.
Incredible. And Miles, to Keon's point just now, he said miles ahead. I mean, that was the thing. Y'all were doing live in person what someone like Q-Tip would end up doing, you know, with Tribe and what Pete would do and, you know, you yourself. And just y'all were doing that first, and it would make, of course y'all were doing it first. It's Miles Davis and Easy Mo B. Like that is crazy, yo. I'm trying not to fan out, but I'm sorry. I guess I want to leave you both with this question, and Keon, I'll start with you. What, at 100 years old, right? And it's interesting because we're talking about hip hop and jazz, and the new centennial version of Miles's biography just came out, and Nas actually wrote one of the forewords for it. His father also being a trumpet player. His father and my dad actually were in a band together, but that's a whole other story. Like, that's the family thing. That's crazy, right? But my question to you guys in closing, Keon, I'll start with you. It's 100 years of Miles Davis, right? But he's more ever present than ever. You know, he's universal. He, you know, generations, doesn't matter. He's like the epitome of cool, like all these things, right? What responsibility do we all share for the next decade and the next decade and the next decade? Like, what do you think the challenge or the responsibility is to keep Miles going into the next 100 years?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, happy birthday, Miles. 100 years of excellence. You know, we are still percolating on, you know, from the 40s to what's being, you know, created and reimagined now. And, you know, I think the thing that is the through line through it all is the spirit. The spirit, the creative spirit, the creative force that Miles always had and, you know, envisioned. The idea that these, you know, that these walls can come down and must come down, and how do we do it? I think if we can keep that spirit, you know, nothing could stop, you know, that quote unquote madness. I know you got something called that, but just, for lack of better words, it's the spirit. If we can keep that spirit alive, it is inspiring. It is intuitive. It is creative. It is inviting, and it is beautiful. So if we can keep that all in intact, I think it'll live forever. And you know, again, with artists like myself and Robert Glasper and Terrace Martin and Kamasi Washington and so many others who really, you know, who also feed on that spirit. It's like, I feel like, you know, if people keep feeding it and being fed by it, it's gonna keep living. So I think that's super important. You know, forever, you know, grateful that I've had the opportunity to engage with this spirit. You know, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Moby, I'll give you the last word. What do we do to keep this legacy alive in from your perspective?
Well, first of all, I think just to be around, to be able to acknowledge that Miles is 100, whether he's alive or not, I just feel so grateful to be able to be a part of the legacy, watching him from the beginning all the way until he left here. He never sat still. He was always changing, changed music so many different times. And this is the first time I ever publicly said this, but I'm glad that I was able to be a part of that last change. Who knows where else he would have continued to take it, because I remember when he pointed to my SB1200 in the studio. So that gives an indication of where this thing could have been taken. But just like Keon said, with people like Glasper, Terrace Martin, Keon, you yourself, I'm glad that the tradition is carrying on. I hope and I pray that a lot of the future generation, younger and those to come, that they will study Miles, not just in a hip-hop kind of way, incorporate him, his greatness, his essence into music that they'll be doing in the future. But me, myself, I feel so grateful. A lot of times I don't even feel worthy to have been a part, to be a part of the legacy and to be a part of that last change, that last turnaround, the corner that he made.
I just have one question. I know you said it was the final, but I just have one question for you, Moby. It's like, what did you, I guess, could you see the impact that it would have, that album, in terms of what future music would be?
Well, I know that a lot of the more introspective people, music lovers, I knew that it would turn them on and do something for them. But internally, within the community of hip-hop, I knew I was going to get some pushback. And then it had the nerve to actually win a Grammy, too. I thought that was the end of Easy Mopey, because, you know, at that time, you know, we loathed about the Grammy. Today, they run and they chase it, but I guess time would change.
Mm-hmm. It's so crazy you say you thought it would be the end of you. And it was literally, you know, just the beginning. Just the beginning, you know, like you just, again, like to echo Keon, you know, you're the greatest. And you literally shaped certainly a huge part of the soundtrack of my life. I know I'm speaking to Keon as well. I mean, just, and even my son, our children who are, you know, what are they, Gen Z-ish?
Gen Z, are they?
Gen Z, yeah. This is the impact, you know, that you're having. And so, you know, and Keon, you too, man, like the impact that you're having on this music. I met Keon when he was 20. He was about his son's age, you know, just incredible.
Well, I'm really, really thankful. First of all, I hold Dubac and the work that we did together in the highest regard. No disrespect to any other artists, but Miles is the greatest thing I've ever done.
Amen to that. No argument from this corner. Mr. Easy Mo B, Mr. Keon Harrell, thank you for spending this time with me, for taking time out of your busy lives to do this. But because it's the centennial, I know you've been both pulled in so many directions. So I just thank
you. It is an honor. Yeah. Every kind.
Shouts to Vince Wilburn Jr. who provided me with the t-shirt.
Vince got us. He got us on the merch.
Yeah. I got to call him and be like, yo, wear my shirt, bro. I have a mild sweatshirt, but it was going to be too hot to wear that. So I had to stick with the Knicks. No, but I love you both. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Happy centennial 100. Miles, we miss you and you love me so much.
Amen. Amen. Thank you. Wow.